These guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you've got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Tuesday afternoon. We're in the Allstate Skyline studio on this edition of the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here. We'll talk charity a little bit later in the program. Andrea Rush is the Senior Vice President of the National Philanthropic Trust, and she'll talk about year-end donations. I'm also interested to see how charitable contributions are doing this year, given the new tax plan. Philip Weiss will be along later in the program to talk about just exactly what gift you should give your boss for the holidays. But we'd like to start on Tuesdays with John Najarian. You watch him on CNBC, of course, from the Najarian Family Office as well. And he joins us to talk Wall Street. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Always a pleasure, Stephen. Thank you.
Okay, so when you say volatility, is this what we're talking about?
This is exactly what we're talking about. I'm
wow.
glad you got that.
Wow.
Yeah. Whether it was yesterday, when we made that dramatic turn off of down 560 or whatever it was to finish positive on the day, whether it was that or whether it's today when we're up 360 and we give it all back because the president and Nancy Pelosi and Schumer have a nice civil discussion at the White House.
Yeah.
on not so much live, it was delayed, but nonetheless, the market reaction was live. And immediately traders knew why we were going down.
It's a funny thing you say that because we all watched it on tape delay. They often do that with things in the White House. They have a pool feed and then come out and feed it to everyone else. But you're right. The reaction on Wall Street preceded the rest of us watching it. We knew something was coming, but they were already trading on it on Wall Street before we saw what it was.
Yeah, that's one of those things that I always complain about because, you know, equal access to information. Clearly, there were people, you know, whether somebody's texting somebody about what's being said, there was an awful lot of stuff that was going out before that. I don't know if it was embargoed. You know what that phrase means, Stephen, but your listeners, just, you know, it means that there's something that's recorded and supposed to not be released until a certain time. Now, I don't know if this tape was that.
It was not.
People were reacting to it.
Yeah, John, it wasn't. I mean, there were reporters reporting out what they were saying before we saw the video, so it wasn't an embargo situation.
Gotcha.
I didn't see if you were on the halftime report today or not. Did you get a chance to watch?
I was.
Did you see the video?
Oh yeah, we heard the whole miserable thing, and it was pretty miserable because you know it's one side fighting against the other side. You know, the one side, of course, wants a wall. The other side doesn't want a wall. Says that they'll negotiate for border security, but not a wall. And the president, you know, much like a petulant child, was digging in his heels saying, hey, I want the wall. And when he demanded that, and they refused, then he said, then I'll shut down the government.
And
I'll shut down the government.
Schumer kind of tricked him into saying, yeah, I'll own it. I'll own the shutdown. Which I think probably he got out.
I don't even know if he tricked him into it. I think he wanted it. He wants to own that.
But here's the thing.
If indeed it's over this, because he's saying they're loose on border security. And they're saying, we're not, but you're categorizing it as that. And he's, you know, that's where they had their big argument.
I'm interested in what you think of my comment, though, John, because you called it miserable. They were clearly both sides were posturing. But it was as close. But it was as close as we've seen to an actual debate among the real players in a long time. I mean, I thought in some ways, I kind of thought it was nice to see. Am I completely wrong?
I agree with you. I agree with you about that point. I say miserable because you know I think that it was all that posturing.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's very similar to what we see and saw yesterday when Theresa May, in front of that august body, Parliament, was basically shouted at, you know, while she's speaking and so forth. We always think that it's just us that is so uncouth, you know, our political process that is so discourteous. But no, this is the way. I don't know if that people have ever seen South Korea or Japan when these guys go to blows in the you know, in their parliaments or their higher ups.
And in England, you know, we know that they were openly laughing at her. And then Theresa May now is on a bit of a tour. I think she met with Merkel today. She's going to be in Dublin tomorrow as she tries to salvage all this. How does the Brexit collapse, if you will, if momentary, how does that play on Wall Street?
Well, it's certainly part of this, but it's not, at least according to what we've heard out of Merkel, there won't be any change. I mean, she said once you enact Article 50, you've done it. You know, you don't get to unring this bell. There'd been a lot of talk about maybe they'll do another referendum. And many of us think if they did that the result would be different. But Merkel, at least, now she's not going to be there perhaps the whole time. But she says you cannot unring that bell. You can't undo Brexit. You are leaving.
All right. I don't know. You know, I ask you to comment on news of the day sometimes, and I don't know which of these news stories is going to be fleeting and which will have some more permanence, right? So the meeting at the White House, probably pretty fleeting. There was word of some progress on the China trade talks, which I would like to think would be more lasting, but that goes back and forth, too. Heading into the trading day today, we were up because there were some positive signs on China. I think car stocks are doing pretty well today, too. So tell me about the China impact on this and what they're feeling there.
Sure. Well, China was actually throwing that olive branch out there saying we may roll back these most recent tariff hikes as part of this cooling off period. In other words, I think last week at this time, Stephen, we were saying we didn't really get the agreement from China on what may or may not have been agreed to in Argentina. But now we finally are getting at least a little bit of that. Because China offered that, and that's why we had that 360-point pop initially today.
All right, so there's that. What are you watching today, John?
Well, we were watching Blackstone, which is an asset manager. We were buying that today, and we were also, which is symbol BX, by the way, and then we were buying Kraft Heinz, KHC, even though you and I probably don't ever put ketchup on a hot dog,
Stephen.
Would not do it. Yep, would not do it either. But there are people who use ketchup for all sorts of things, and it's not the only thing that Kraft Heinz makes. But the stock's been very weak this year, and I think it's a great place to buy it at about $49 a share.
All right, that's John Najarian. You can see him on CNBC. Also follow John at John Najarian on Twitter. Thanks for joining us, friend. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephen. Have a great one, sir.
You will. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, it is that time of year. We're talking about shopping there with Loot2Go.com or maybe charitable giving. Andrea Rush is the Senior Vice President at the National Philanthropic Trust, and she joins us on a phone line now. Andrea, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hello, Steve. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to join you.
Just for joining me, I'm going to donate $50 to the Philanthropic Trust. There you go. So my charitable giving.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
My giving is half done for the year. So we talk a lot about on this program about the tax reform and the implication it will have on giving for 2018. Are the numbers in? What does it look like so far?
So we're all waiting with bated breath to see what the end of the calendar year brings in terms of the implications of tax reform on charitable organizations this year. We're hoping that people, Americans, are the most philanthropic in the world. And so we're really hoping that people just continue to give to their charities despite the fact that they might not be able to use the itemized deductions. And we'll really know at the end of the calendar year.
So we don't really have a good feel for it just yet anyway.
No. Most of the individual donations that happen in the U.S., 40% of individuals give in the last 6 weeks of the year. So this is really crunch time for all of the charities.
There has been a big jump, right, in the donor-advised funds. I know there you guys had a report on that earlier this year. We've mentioned that as well, where people can donate early and then sort of allocate them over the years.
That's correct. So with a donor advised fund, you can really take advantage throughout the calendar year. You can make your donation into a donor advised fund at any particular time during the year, take the tax deduction in that particular tax year, and then spread your giving out over whatever period of time you'd like.
Okay, so give us some advice. You know, we're sitting at home, we're watching television, the telephone rings, and it's a charity who wants us to give some money. We hear a great story about all the great work they do, or maybe about the poor children they help. Is it ever a good idea to donate money to someone who calls you at home?
So if it's a bona fide charity that's reaching out to you, by all means. But I would encourage people to pause and really think about what is most important to you in your giving, and not to make those knee-jerk reactions. Donors should always weigh up the charities that they're trying to support, do a little bit of research, a little bit of homework to understand the finances and how that organization is run.
That's sort of advice, then, just kind of slow down, right? There's no reason to be in a rush, and just because someone has you on a phone or someone has you on a street corner doesn't mean you have to make a decision right then.
Of course. And charitable giving is something that's so personal to each and every one of us. So it really has to gel with your values. You should find the mission of that particular charity motivational to you as a donor. And so I would never feel pressured to give to a particular charity.
You know, Andrea, that's a great point. So I wonder how many people, though, seek out charities rather than have charities seek them out. I mean, I bet most contributions are solicited rather than searched for. Does that make any sense?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. I know myself, this time of year, I'm getting at least 4 or 5 pieces of mail each and every day, emails pouring in, charitable solicitations. And I think it's a really good point for anyone listening to sort of develop an overall giving strategy. The organizations that are the tried and true ones that they want to support year over year, those charities are really dependent on those donations from them.
So decide what you're going to give this year. I mean, we're at the end of the year. Be a little proactive. Seek out the charity or the causes. And be careful even then, right? Because there are a lot of scam charities that try to make themselves sound like legitimate charities.
That's right. And donors should always do a little bit of research to find out. It's really simple just to go on a charity's website, perhaps take a look at their annual report, see their financials, see who is on their board of directors, see the programs that they're actually running, and the impact that those programs are having in the community.
Is there anything that, someone like me, just a little old donor, can learn from the big philanthropist? I mean, do we have anything in common, any lessons I could pick up from them?
So we've learned a lot from the philanthropists over the years. I would think many of the venture philanthropists, Bill Gates springs to mind. He's caused so much good in the world to come out of his giving, and he's been a model for other philanthropists around the world. So, but each one of us can be a philanthropist in our own way. You can give your time, you can give your treasure, and you can give your talent. So anyone, even a child, can be a philanthropist and really donate in the way that is most important to them.
Andrea Rush is the Senior Vice President at the Philanthropic Trust, the National Philanthropic Trust. I wish you a very charitable new year. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Steve, and Happy New Year and Happy Holidays to you as well.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. This is Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. All right, every year I see the millions and millions of people who travel for the holidays and feel badly for them because it's not something I've done. Well, this year I am going to be one of the 45.7 million passengers who are flying, not strictly because of the holidays, but a family wedding just after New Year. So I'll be part of this busy trend, this busy crowd, to help me find my way to the airport and then back home. Nick Calio is on the phone line, the CEO of Airlines for America. Nick, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, so Airlines for America, that is basically the trade association for, is it international airlines in the country or domestic airlines only?
It is domestic airlines and both passenger and cargo carriers.
All right, and so 45.7 million people flying this year is an increase from last year, correct?
Yes, from last year, we're up about 5.2%. We're expecting, like you said, 45.7 million passengers. That's an increase of about 126,000 passengers a day. To accommodate them, the airlines are providing an additional 143,000 seats a day. Right. And Steve, you know, I would note one thing. I wouldn't feel sorry for those people because those people are going home to see their families, going overseas on vacations with their families, and they couldn't do it if airfares were not as accessible and as affordable as they are today.
Reading your group now, Nick, I've lost the phrase, but it was something about the it's the accessibility, airline accessibility, or a phrase like that you guys use when compared to the days of deregulation, about how, you know, we all complain Correct. About the airlines, but we can afford to fly on them now. And it really is sort of a revolutionary time when you consider that.
It is. You know, I'm a Cleveland guy, and I tell all the time, when I grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, nobody in my neighborhood got on an airplane because Right. we simply couldn't afford it.
Right.
Now everybody does. If you look at the statistics on this, I find truly compelling. I was surprised when I first learned it. About 40% of the people who fly today have family incomes under $50,000. 58% have family incomes under $75,000. So today, really, unlike the old times when everybody was an airline had to charge a certain amount for every ticket as dictated by the government. Now that we have competition, fares are way down and way accessible. They're down about 42%, including the ancillary fees adjusted for inflation since 1980.
You know, and the people who complain about it say, yeah, well, they're taking a plane now. People deal with it like it's riding a bus. But in many ways, it has become like riding a bus.
Well, that's because more people are flying
right,
and the seats
right.
are full.
No, but I mean, I don't mean that as a bad thing. I mean, it's become so much more accessible. We're all able to do it in a way that we couldn't before.
That's exactly right.
All right, so if there's 126,000 extra passengers a day flying over the holidays, you know, I've been on flights, Nick. I don't see 126,000 extra seats on the planes. Do they add flights? Do they add aircraft? Or how do the airlines make up for that?
They add seats. In some cases, they may add flights, but it's mostly in addition to seats. And, you know, you don't see it, but there's 27,000 flights go out every day in this country with about 5.2 million passengers. So it's a matter of sometimes of adding additional flights. More than that, they can add seats to it, make more seats available.
How do they do that? They just cut down on friends and family, or how do they make more seats available?
By adding seats to the flights, I think.
But you mean, so adding, I don't understand that, Nick. Adding seats on the airplane?
Yeah, larger airplanes.
I see. Okay,
for example.
I got you. So they're not adding a flight.
On certain routes.
Okay, I'm a little slow here. So they're not creating a new flight, but they might be flying a bigger aircraft on the existing flight.
Yeah, and I think I was the one who was a little bit slow to be
thirsty. No, it's okay. Okay, so tell me, I want to talk about fuel prices as well, because I see the projection for 2019 is that fuel prices will be lower, which I'm assuming would be good for airlines. But one of the industry analysts I read said, well, it could be dangerous as well, because there could be the lure of a fare war. And when it comes to airline profits, that wouldn't be good for the airline companies, although it might be good for the passengers.
I don't agree with that. We take fuel prices into account all the time. It's our second largest cost after our employees. So we're very, very careful about it. And we're in a very different time than we were in the 80s and 90s, where airline executives would make decisions to try to have a fare war or lure passengers and throw a whole bunch of seats that they knew they couldn't fill at a particular market because fuel prices were lower. We're very disciplined in how we govern our business these days, and that's in terms of both fuel, passengers, labor, and investment back into the business, which has been considerable. You know, we started making money again consistently in 2010,
yeah.
And over the last 4 years, U.S. airlines have been investing about $1.6 billion a month back into their businesses. That's in terms of investments in technology, investments in new aircraft, in lounges, in the seating, in overhead bins, and all sorts of things like that. So I guess what I'm saying is we're disciplined because we want our passengers to get on the plane, we want our passengers to be happy, and we want to keep airfares affordable and accessible.
It's one of those things, too, that we take advantage or take for granted, I guess, but it is a remarkably safe way to travel, and it's a little bit of magic, you know, that I can go to O'Hare Airport with a winter coat, and then 2.5-3 hours later, get off a jet in San Diego in my shorts, and know that I can do that reliably and on time. That's a pretty cool thing.
It is a very good thing, and our on-time performance is better than it ever has been. And again, those 27,000 flights and all those people, I consider it a miracle. So I don't think you could have said it. I couldn't say it any better than you did. And when people say to me, you know, well, what about this? Well, you know, you're not going from Washington to the Napa Valley for the weekend. You'd prefer probably not to drive from Washington to Chicago, and you can get there. It is a miracle, and people don't understand that every time they get on a plane, but they keep getting on the plane because it's very convenient. It's part of their way of life now.
Nick Calio is the CEO of Airlines for America. Thanks for talking. Next time you talk, we'll take on the baggage fees, okay? We'll put that off till next time after the holidays.
That's a deal, Steve. Thank you very much.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. There are some serious rumblings going on in the food innovation world, mainly coming from the Instacart delivery people, who are not happy with their employers because they're reportedly getting underpaid. Instacart sees the delivery people as independent contractors, which is one of the biggest concerns in the gig economy world. According to an example of the Tribune report that broke this story, a delivery of over 500 cans of soup over a period of time only paid out $21, a drop from what would have been $75 before the pay change. So clearly, a concern that needs to be addressed. And all eyes will be on the California-based company and how it goes about this problem. It's definitely going to be in the spotlight as the rest of the gig economy watches. And another spotlight that's shining down is on Acorn Inc., a drug maker located in the Lake Forest area. And their sitting CEO is stepping down because of a rapid downturn of business, resulting in a blow-up of a $4.5 billion buyout deal with another healthcare company. This is why they make big bucks. How do you take a challenge like this and come out of it? I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank on 720 WGN. Philip Weiss is in the studio. He is the president of WorkRight Solutions and joins us from time to time to talk about advice in the workplace. Philip, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So it's holiday time, gift-giving time. You know, the Steve Cochran Show had a grab bag today for the people who work on their show. They excluded the rest of us, but that's okay. I didn't feel too badly. But that's kind of the way to go, right? You like the idea of a grab bag.
Yeah. I mean, the exclusionary part is a bit worrisome, but
well,
I know you...
I got to say, one of the guys gave a woman leggings.
So that's another worrisome, potentially worrisome moment. I can't speak to what happened here.
No.
I don't want to go that far. But you raised some really important questions, which is we don't want to put a kibosh on these traditions of sort of sharing the merriment
right.
and sharing some gifts. But employers are increasingly seeing that they have to set some real parameters on the appropriateness and the amount people are spending on each other.
So I was reading some of your guidance, and if you're a boss and your employees give you gifts, is that an acceptable thing?
Well,
I mean, I'm trying to think, Philip, when I read it, I don't know that I've ever given my boss a gift as just like from employee-boss sort of relationship.
Yeah, it's rare, which is a good thing because it can be incredibly destabilizing to the workplace, as you can imagine. We worked with a company where there was a independently wealthy employee who just loved their job
right.
and loved their boss. And their manager, and gave their manager a Vespa scooter.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was apparently no skin off that gentleman's nose.
Right.
But all the other employees looked at the gift and said, now, what do we have to get the boss to get a promotion, like a motorhome, or what's the next level here?
So should the boss have said no?
Yes. In that case, in fact, that was the outcome of sort of the follow-up we engaged in, which is to say, if bosses say yes to gifts, they lose control in terms of whether there's a pecking order established,
mm-hmm.
who gets the boss the best gift, is a gift expected the next year. So if you're running a company and you can explain to your managers, find a way to tactfully turn down gifts, use a policy if you need to, use a language, but encourage people to say, look, at the thanks I need is a hard work you're doing for me.
I'm smiling because we have this conversation almost monthly, but there's always a different immediate subject, but it's always a bigger bigger term sort of thing where I'm like, yeah, but you know, if you're friends and you want to give a gift, you know, everyone knows that it's the right thing to do or the wrong thing, it should be okay.
Well, that's a really great point. That's why a lot of companies realize they can't have some hard and fast policy, some absolute prohibition, But guidelines are helpful. And I think employees, at least the ones we've surveyed, they're relieved to know they shouldn't spend more than, let's say, $5, $10, or $15 on each other and know that there's not going to be an embarrassing moment.
Should employers give employees gifts, individual gifts?
That's another important question. And we're really seeing almost a veering away from that for the same reason, unless you can be really consistent.
Right.
And ensure that you're not creating this feeling that, what am I going to get next year? We call it giftflation.
Right.
Is it going to go up next year or not? It can be safe, but more companies are doing something that's probably really appropriate. They're saying, let's give a communal gift to some worthy cause, and let's encourage managers to thank their employees. It may sound like less fun, but it's certainly safer.
It sounds like so much less fun.
Well, the reality is we're not going to stop all gift giving, but when you look at some of the horror stories out there, a little control is
probably
good.
You're just avoiding trouble. Right. I mean, I don't like it when someone gives a gift. This sounds terrible. Okay. So everyone, I'm not a bad guy, but I'm going to say I don't like it when someone gives money to a charity in my name. Because I feel like, not that I want the gift part of it, but I feel like they're kind of doing it for themselves in some ways.
Well, that's a really important point. And when we've done anonymous surveys of employees, we do get some of that reaction. Yeah. But we get many more people saying, I wish there wasn't an expectation that I would donate to the internal fund.
Right.
So it's interesting because there may not be a perfect solution here, but there are some approaches that can work. You know, you mentioned sort of maybe leggings or stockings. That's actually a great example of something to think about. Any gift that might touch the body, and that might be underclothes or any clothes, perfume or body oils, that's something to think twice about. So you can actually engage in the maybe Secret Santa without getting sort of touchy in terms of the actual gift.
So, I mean, you always come in here with great stories of inappropriate gifts. Tell me about the his and her glasses.
Yeah, so this is an interesting one because this involved a law firm that we helped, consulted for. And one of the partners of the firm was on a business trip with a client. And they were in a gift shop, and they saw these sort of his and her matching nude-shaped wine goblets.
Uh-huh.
And they both cracked up.
Right.
I won't comment about that moment because, you know, that's what they did. But the lawyer who represented this client then thought, because the guy laughed, he probably would really appreciate these goblets, these nude-shaped goblets as a gift.
Right.
But in fact, that violated the rules of the client, and the business relationship ended there.
It cost the client.
It cost the client.
Now, tell me inadvertently that the woman bought it for the man?
I don't want to get too specific.
Okay.
But we've seen it in all directions, which is an important point you raised, even if I admitted something about my client.
All right, a little advice then. What should bosses do if they want to set up? I have to tell you, too, grab bags and things like that.
Yeah.
I have a reputation as sort of a curmudgeon around here because I don't like just being forced into things like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I can tell someone Merry Christmas or Happy Hanukkah or whatever without buying them something that they don't really want anyway and they're going to throw away when they get home.
Yeah. So on the one hand, we got to be realistic. People are going to share gifts, particularly at the same level. That's going to keep happening. It is important to encourage people, if they have friends at work, to keep these kinds of exchanges outside of the workplace.
Okay.
So we haven't ended it altogether. However, in the workplace, with people watching someone open a present, it is helpful to either have some structure, like let employees do that grab bag approach. Maybe a vendor gives you a giant mountain of candy. Divide that among everybody, even the team in the mailroom and the maintenance staff.
Don't forget the maintenance guys.
That's right. So there's ways to get the bling distributed without offending people.
Philip Weiss is the president of WorkRight Solutions. Thanks for coming by. Hey, have a great holiday season.
Same to you. Thank you.